My name is Owen Flynn and welcome to episode 119 of the Trail Running Ireland podcast, sponsored by EcoTrail Wicklow 2025. In this week's show, we have Rennie Borg from Running Coach Ireland discussing how walking might actually be a secret weapon to help us run faster and run longer. And we have Ireland's top performer at the UTMB World Series Finals Mont Blanc 2025. And she has just ran Ireland's highest ever finish at UTMB Mont Blanc. Emma Stewart is here to talk us through her superb 11th place in the 175-kilometre UTMB race through three countries alongside the best ultra-trail runners in the world. Everybody, get your running gear on. Let's go. Hey guys, how are you? I hope you all had a superb summer. I hope it went fantastic for you and you are enjoying getting some routine back into the weekly schedule. And routine is a runner's best friend, if you ask me. And well, guys, what a few weeks it has been with some big, big races, some big results happening within the Irish trail and mountain running community. But before we touch on them, a big shout out to our sponsor for this episode, EcoTrail Wicklow, who are just over 2 weeks away now from their sixth edition. And we are looking forward to a superb day of trail running on Saturday, September 27th on the historic Bray Promenade, where you'll have the start and finish line, Race HQ, with a DJ, of course, as well, with the team from Wicklow Wolf there at the finish line with their exceptional locally produced beer on offer for the finishers. If you haven't got your race entry yet, there are five races again this year with a distance for everybody: 10k, 19k, 30k, 46k, and the big one, the 80k, with stunning routes that go through Brayhead, Little and Great Sugarloaf, Kilruddery Gardens, Powerscourt Waterfalls, Loch Tay, Varty Reservoir, and of course the Wicklow Way. There's lots of ancillary events around the race weekend as well and in the build-up, and the race works with some exceptional local partners such as Dynafit, Wicklow Wolf, Nobo and Inner Fight, who are organising the last of the Recce runs out on the course this Saturday, September 13th. So do make sure to check out the EcoTrail Wicklow socials for everything that's happening and to get that race entry, guys, as well. Before we call in Rene, just a quick catch up on the results after an exceptional few weeks of racing. Firstly, well done to the Irish Masters 100 strong team who raced brilliantly at the World Masters Mountain Running Championships in Medugno, Italy, where we won 22 team podium medals, including four team gold medals. Four Irish teams are champions of the world, and five silver individual world championship medals were taken home, with Ian Conroy taking home the gold medal in the World M40 Uphill Championship. So a massive congrats to all of the team management and support crews for making that World Championships a World Championships to remember for Ireland. And do check out the IMRA website, guys, and there's a good article on Run Republic as well for a more detailed set of those results and how to get involved in future World and European Championships with that Irish team. The Kerryway Ultra took place this weekend just gone as well. And congrats to the champions, Conor Keane and Emer Lynch, who were clear winners in the 200k Ultra. Niamh Fitzpatrick and Fabian Devlin won the 101k night race. And in the ultra light, 58 kilometres in that one, Carol and Erbeli from Germany won the race, with Fiona Doody in second. And in the men's race, Jamie O'Sullivan won that one. The last round of the Irish Mountain Running Championships also took place there last weekend on the iconic slopes of Carn Tuathail. Caroline Harney Aiton won the race and cemented her place as the champion for 2025 with a perfect record of four wins from four races. And in the men's race, Brian Mullins won in 1 hour 35 minutes, but it was Irish international Matthew McConnell who took the overall title with, just like Caroline, a perfect score, 3 wins from 3. We'll talk more about UTMB with Emma later on, guys, but just a congrats to the 27 or so Irish athletes who took on Mont Blanc there this year. A great achievement to get to that start line and then to complete it as well, because it is hard to qualify for UTMB Mont Blanc. So well done to all the Irish who crossed that finish line. And with so many epic racing, so much epic racing taking place over the last 6 weeks or so, I suspect our next slot with our coaching slot with Rene might be helpful and might play a key part in your recovery routine, maybe over the next fortnight or so. Let's call Rennie in. Rene Borg from Running Coach Ireland. Rene, we are kicking off a new season, September. And in fairness to you, Rene, you've come up with a superb topic. We've often spoken in the past about slowing things down into zone 1 and zone 2 in order to go faster. But today, we're going to slow things down even further. And we've got a fascinating topic. We're going to talk about why walking can actually be very, very beneficial for us runners. Rennie, it nearly sounds too simple. Walking, can it be good for us? Take it away.
Yeah, well, maybe a few of the Irish competing at UTMB over the weekend, you know the value of walking. You know, I don't mean that to disparage them, but you know, we all know that quite a bit of walking has to be done in the steep alpine slopes. We're kind of not talking about that sort of hiking necessarily, although that's part of it, you know. So walking sounds very simple, but because it's so fundamental, you know, you can't do anything without doing some kind of walking. Like, you can't go out and get a cup of coffee, you know, you can't walk the dog in the morning, you can't do anything, you know. So most runners, they don't really see it as exercise, and we probably nearly see it as a defeat. So that makes that kind of makes running a gear of speed that we skip, but that our bodies are actually built on.
Yeah. But I remember back in June when I had that groin tear, and walking actually became part of my training as I was trying to rehab back to running. And walking for maybe about 10 days or so was actually part of my structured training. But I'm sure we might touch upon that later on. And before we dive into the science, just 2 books that we can talk about, Rennie, today. The first one, I think everybody knows, Born to Run. Christopher McDougall's book that launched the whole barefoot boom and told us that humans are endurance runners by design. But there's another one, a less famous one, Born to Walk.
Yeah, and by an Irishman, I believe, James Earls. He wrote it back in 2014, you know, and there's actually, I think, a book that came out this year of the same title by Mark Sisson. We come into that a little bit later. But their argument is that walking is an even deeper evolutionary foundation than running. And I know, you know, we've spoken about functional patterns on the podcast as well, and they've made a similar argument that there's actually 3 things. It's walking, running, and throwing. You know, we won't go down all of that, but essentially what they're saying, both are true in a sense. So running is kind of like your hunting gear, and walking is your living gear. So that means both matter, but walking is the baseline for the running. So if you actually put McDougall and Peterson side by side, the truth is we're born to walk and to run, you know, and functional patterns might say walk and run and throw. I say we won't go to the throwing today. So in the modern world, it's because we, you know, we're very efficiency driven, and we'll talk more about that as well. We tend to skip walking except the part that is part of life, right? You know, the part you don't think about because you can't leave that out. So, you know, we thought maybe talk about why it's important to maybe bring a bit of consciousness into how can you bring it back. So, for instance, as you've already noticed, when you're seriously injured, you often find, well, I still really want to get out there and move about. And suddenly you see, oh, well, walking could play a part here in that journey. But could it be used proactively as well, instead of just kind of reactively to an injury? That's one of the things we want to cover.
Yeah, and people, I think, often think as the first gear of our training, Rennie, the first speed that we can get in our training is very, very easy jogging. But first gear isn't necessarily easy jogging. First gear can actually be walking.
Yeah, that would be a better way to think of it, you know, especially for beginners, you know. But it's, so if we say walking, okay, it's the first gear of the transmission. So running would skip that gear in a way, even easy jogging, you know, it's kind of like you go straight into second gear. Is there a problem with that? Well, yes and no, in that there isn't like a massive difference between super slow running and walking, but walking does have certain benefits. Like if you put them side by side in a table, where it has a different effect than even slow jogging. So for instance, you're guaranteed with walking that it's pure fat metabolism. You get a lot more joint hydration. There's some mechanical reasons for that. It's a much stronger parasympathetic recovery stimulus. It also has a very unique effect that if you, for instance, go for a short walk after you have any meal, it hugely improves your body's glucose control. And it's a strong, what do you call it, a neurological reset for the body. And then there's a real bonus probably for a lot of people is you can do loads of it without breaking down. You know, so you can get a lot of time on your feet.
And it's not just theory, Rennie. History proves that it works. And we also see a lot of modern athletes using walking deliberately as well.
Yeah, because when I pitched this to you know, the names I put out, you know, maybe one of them you had to check because they're quite old, you know, and they probably betrays that I always had a love for that era of running, 1800, early 1900s, just because I'm a bit nostalgic, I suppose. But it's like there was Alfred Schrupp, they called him the Little Wonder. He was a multiple world record holder from I think around 1920s or so. He trained heavily with walking, you know, and despite all the walking he did, he was a really fast runner. And then Arthur Newton, who's called the father of ultra running, his whole schedules were built around combining walking and running. So he actually tracked both his walking volume and his running volume. And that's because the context he lived in was they didn't think of themselves as runners. They thought of themselves as pedestrians. That was a form of sport. They were professionals. And they basically just covered extreme distances, running or walking for money. You know, so for them, it wasn't even a question of differentiating, really. You know, they saw both as an integral whole.
So running, it's, or sorry, walking. People might have said in the past, for example, Tony Riddle, you mentioned before, and a couple of times in the podcast, people might have said that, well, walking can lead to bad habits. It can be bad for our running mechanics, but not necessarily.
No, and actually, before I go off on that one, I did forget to say those old names weren't the only ones, right? If anyone looks up, we'll skim through it fairly quick because anyone can Google this. If you look at Cillian Jornet, Courtney Dowater, Jim Walmsley, all those names, right? You see the amount of hiking blocks that goes into their prep. So, you know, if you have a look around yourself, you'll actually see that it's still a practice. It's not just an outdated practice, you know, from my 1900s nostalgia. But yeah, to go into Tony Riddle, so he used to argue that back, this was over 10, 11 years ago, that if you, he, what do you call it, that walking like cycling has a risk of diluting your running form. You know, because he saw a lot of the movement as being basically contradictory to the type of strength that you need in running. But his philosophy, it's either evolved over the last 11, he's called the natural lifestylist now, that's his brand. But he communicates it differently, or his philosophy evolved a bit, because now he's basically what they call a rewilding expert. So that means he talks about barefoot walking, posture drills, primal movement, all of this. So I think in hindsight, the caution that he put out and others might have put out about walking being detrimental to runners, it was not about avoiding walking. You know, it was just that you need to walk better. And you also need to understand that, you know, to actually become the best runner, you need to be strong enough for the demands of running. You know, so walking in itself is not enough, but it doesn't mean it's not part of the foundation that gets you there.
Yeah, and of course, there can be limits to just running alone. Well, we know the great many benefits of running. Running doesn't necessarily cover everything in terms of an athlete's development.
No, like a lot of people know Jay Dechary, right? Who had, I think it was called The Runner's Body and Anatomy for Runners, you know, two fairly influential books, you know. And he points out that running is not enough to make you strong because of the nature of the activity. So running contact time is too short to create the signal that the body responds to optimally, well, basically to optimally load the tendons and bones. Running is not enough. And that means you don't get the level of tendon stiffness, bone density, and muscle strength that you actually need to run strong from running alone. So that means if all you do is run like from a sedentary background, you can get fit, but you might lack the durability that's especially important, right, for the really long distance runners.
I think it's a very clear message beginning to come true that walking certainly won't break you. It won't break you down. It won't ruin you. But running alone doesn't complete you either. You can get a lovely sweet spot of the two of them together.
Yeah, we could nearly have another topic, right? Maybe we will, because basically you could say walking fills some of the, especially metabolic gaps at the lower end, and some of the biomechanical, you could say structural foundation for running. Strength is on the other side. It fills especially the structural gaps that we have, as we just mentioned, at tendons, bones, muscular strength. So running gives you the engine in between. So the three things kind of build the athlete. And I think what confuses, and the reason it's not in a lot of the training programs, especially like the big historical training books, is that people in the past didn't have to think about those things because they were, carrying water, they were chopping wood, maybe they worked really manual jobs, they were climbing, they were building, so they had all these daily tasks that gave their bones and tendons that what we could describe as heavy, slow, high strain work, right? Actually, what we described as high torque work on one of our last podcasts. So running cannot provide that alone. It's very difficult. So today we just sit. So we have to actually consciously and deliberately add that strength in. And people may remember, some people, we used to do natural movement workshops long, long time ago. And actually the core message was live actively, have a rounded movement routine, and then you run on top of that. But most of the runners who came in, and to a certain degree ourselves as well, we focused on the running bit. Because really, a runner's psychology is we just want to run. And like nearly everybody, you kind of hear or focus on what you want to hear and you disregard the rest, right? So, if there was any time constraint, the other stuff goes and you focus on the running part that you learned. But the walking and strength is what we need to put back, what our lives used to give us automatically. And then we can have our running routine sit on top of that.
I think you might have mentioned, Rennie, just at the top of the conversation today, Nico jogging. And would that be a good alternative if you don't have the patience to walk? Would Nico jogging work for you? And actually, funny, when I for the first time I ever I actually saw some real life athletes doing some Nico jogging there last week at UTMB in Chamonix. The week before, or sorry, the day before the UTMB race itself on the Friday and the Thursday, I was out doing a run just down by the river that goes through the town, nice flat bit of town. And I was cruising along and I came across two Japanese athletes, and the two of them were in perfect sync, perfect unison, doing their Nico jogging, and they were just watching the world go by. Step they were nearly going at walking pace, but they did have that slow jog rhythm about them, and it was a sight to behold. I must admit, I don't know if I'd have the patience to do that myself, but what do you think, Nico jogging versus walking?
Yeah, it's hard and it's a little bit similar to the kind of Kenyan morning shuffle before they really kick into gear as well, So it's Nico is great for that low intensity, fat friendly running as well. So it's the most similar to walking, but it's still running. Okay, so you still have a higher impact, you have a higher cadence, so it's still kind of plyometric. There's more carb usage if you happen to be tired on the day you do it. So walking is still kind of unique in the way that there's largely no impact. It's always fat burning unless you're like hyper stressed. It improves that whole post meal glucose and joint hydration that we said in a way that jogging doesn't. So both have a place. And I remember actually once really noticing it when I was doing some hiking after an ultra because we were away on holidays, and it was so noticeable how the walking actually healed the body. You could just feel that. So that's probably where that whole joint hydration came in, and it just really relaxed it out. And I don't think even slow jogging, even if it was Nico with a smile and everything, would have quite done that.
Yeah, and we are seeing the importance of walking hitting mainstream media. Authors like Mark Sisson, they're putting walking front and center.
Yeah, and he looks great for 70. It's kind of funny that he's mainstream now because, 20 years ago he probably wasn't. And I think as he has aged, he's starting to write books a little bit more for his own kind of, what would you say, demographic, you know. So he's really strong on how walking is the foundation for health and longevity, especially as you age, you know, because we can walk all day basically, you know, with no limits. And that means your fat, if you do lots of that, your fat metabolism, which often in modern societies we've talked about recently, with all the carbs around, often our fat metabolism is actually really damaged, you know, and people are pre-diabetic and whatnot. It's a great, easy way to stay upright and posture, you know, and get down your stress. So it's really not for athletes, just like it's something that's really good for everybody. So you can see why he wanted to write that. And that means then for the competitors and the athletes, it's about how you layer running on top of that instead of just saying, look, I'm an athlete. I don't have time for that, so I just skip it. But for the general population, you know, if there's anyone listening who considers them, then that it can be, you can use it even more, you know, rather than just a supplement. Like it could be a massive part of your exercise routine.
Yeah, and I mean, at the end of the day, Rennie, it is part of our evolution. We've always walked long distances, and we do have to be careful that we don't resist that natural ability to walk from A to B, given, you know, how busy we all are.
Yeah, because you sometimes even notice it when you stop walking altogether and you go out on a long kind of fast pack or run or something, you sometimes actually notice that you've gotten bad at walking, which is a little bit, you know, it's not great, not even tactically. But like humans probably, depending on what study you look at, they probably walked 10, 15, 20 kilometers a day. Like, and today people obviously wear Fitbits and watches and they have competitions in the offices to how many steps they take. And that has actually done some good things, you know, in getting people to walk more and to become aware. I think back often on to when I used to have to walk to the Lewis and back, you know, and I had both ends of my trip to work, and it actually added up to a good few kilometers as well. N like nothing like a hunter gatherer, but if you even think about it, if you walk your dog 2 kilometers a day, that's over 700 kilometers of walking a year. You know, so it adds up very quickly, and then you can add all that little walking you do around to just to get around. Whereas the problem is we all then we get older, we get more money, we just jump into our cars, and slowly a lot of that movement base, you could see those kilometers just disappear, and maybe nearly the only thing that we have is the run, you know. So in a sense we go from 0 to 100, you know, we just sit and then we jump straight into marathons, you know. It's kind of like skipping ahead, and that makes then walking feel like something optional, but you actually lost something that should have been an automatic stimulus every day.
It's been a fascinating topic, Rennie. And maybe just to close off the conversation for today, can you give us maybe four or five practical takeaways, four or five examples of how we can actually incorporate walking into our training? And I might just give one from my side as well, based on two conversations that I've had with two of my own athletes over the last week or so. And that is replacing their cool down with a walk, because some of the guys, you know, they're starting to do their big Dublin marathon training, fast finish long runs at the minute, where we might do maybe an hour at easy pace, an hour at marathon pace, and then maybe 8 to 10 minutes at a faster than marathon pace. And then I always just maybe include, say, 6 to 8 minutes of a gentle jog cool down. And one of the lads just said to me the other day, "Oh, I just cannot face that final 8 minutes of a jog cool down. Do you mind if I just walk it?" And I said, "Absolutely, Andy. Enjoy that walk. You know, walk for 10, 15 minutes, reflect back on the training session. And the walking is probably just as good as the jog, and maybe even better, because your body's already probably pounded from 28, 30 kilometers of a fast finish marathon session. So sometimes a walk and a cool down instead of a jog can be a good thing."
Yeah, and I think I can't remember if we did a topic on it own, but it's been a huge discussion point online that actually there's a lot of evidence coming out that the cool down is not really very well supported, you know, there's a in terms of evidence. So today we know that walking kind of makes you go come down a level. So I think that's people should play with it, right? But the biggest problem with walking probably is that we live in a really efficiency driven world, a time pressurized world. So you're like, you know, I'd rather do 20 minutes intense training than waste an hour walking, right? You know, or you know, you finish your run and you don't feel, you know, I don't have time to be doing 10 minutes. Or I do it myself, and sometimes when I'm really busy, I think, ah, I won't walk the dog this morning. You know, he already got a walk with Aoife an hour earlier. But you know, it's kind of stupid because those whatever 15 minutes I spent just walking it back and forth sets you up so well for the day, you know, and then you're more prepared. So you have to kind of layer it into your life where it makes sense and where you feel it gives you something. Like it could be 15 minutes after each meal that you try and find a quick 10, 15 minute work, because then straight away you get better glucose control. So it means you'll probably help gain less fat as well. You know, you could do a fasted walk first thing in the morning, just get the fat metabolism really ramped up. Might get you the whole morning sunlight we often talk about as well. As you said there, post-run cool-down walks instead, you know, might work, especially for masters runners who don't need to just, you know, count every mile to get the mega volume in. It could be an evening walk you do before sleep, especially if you have sleep issues, you know, to get your heart rate variability up, feel more relaxed. And then maybe longer walks in the weekends, or maybe combine it as something you do with your family, you know, a chance to pay them back a bit. You know, you go for a long walk together, the kids love it. Sometimes they don't, right? But there's so many ways, because it like running, it's really easy, and you don't even have to get into exercise gear, right? Because you're not going to sweat a lot unless you go out up the hill. So you really, anytime you have a chance, and today people do, this is probably 10 years old now, even the walking meetings, right? And I admit, although this is probably less stress reducing, I sometimes take calls or go through, you know, I send all my WhatsApp replies back to clients while I'm walking.
Absolutely. I wonder if any do 18-hole rounds at a golf course. Do they count as a good addition to our training? Maybe a bit too much. I've often had a conversation with my marathon guys who might do a big long run on the Saturday, and then they've got 18 rounds of golf on the Sunday, and I'm trying to get to shut down their golfing season over the next couple of weeks before Dublin. So not in excess either.
No, and I think it depends on how well you do, because otherwise it might be a bit too much stress.
Listen, Randy, that was a great topic. I think Born to Run gave us one truth that humans are natural runners, and Born to Walk has given us another, that walking is certainly the foundation of everything that we might potentially do as a runner. Randy, a superb topic. Thanks a million, mate, and we'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure, Owen. All right, talk to you soon.
Before we call in Emma, a sincere thank you to our group of Patreons who support the show each month with the price of a gel per month. Really appreciate it, guys. And special thank you to Pierre O'Conhela and Alice Clancy, who became Patreons over the last few weeks. And if you listen in, if you would like to also help out the podcast, do please pop over to patreon-trailrunningireland. When, if you have a moment over the next couple of days, guys, over the next couple of weeks, for a small donation of the price of a gel for a month or two, that alone will help keep us going all year round. Okay, let's call in the fantastic Emma Stewart, who has had an incredible record of race wins over ultra distances on the mountains, on the trails over the last few years. And last week she went head to head with the best in the world at the UTMB World Series Finals, 175 kilometres. Let's hear all about it.
Emma, as I was just saying to you there offline before I hit the record button, so looking forward to talking to you. I'm sure the listeners, the trail running community back home in Ireland, are all looking forward to listening to you as well. Certainly, in my opinion, Emma, Ireland's greatest ever UTMB Mont Blanc result, 11th overall against the best runners in the world. Congratulations, Emma. Brilliant to have you on. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. No, good to chat again. I don't know if I was in much of a fit state to speak to you at the end of the race.
Well, listen, with a race with what? About a 39% DNF rate. The fact that you got to the finish line and we're just one place out beside the top 10, my God. But you got your category podium, I think, Emma, didn't you? So you still got to go up for the prize-giving ceremony on the Sunday, I hope.
Yeah, I was second in my age category because Ruth Croft's in the same age category as me. So I still got a wee trophy, a wee memento, because they don't give out medals, they just give out gilets. So I still have a wee memento to put on my shelf. So it's not so bad.
Well, listen, nice to be second on the podium to Will Croft, isn't it? But come here, Emma, I was thinking like how to chat through the race and the whole weekend for you, and maybe to try and take it in chronological order. Because, of course, this time last year, it didn't go as well, and you did have a DNF. So maybe before we talk about this year, just a quick reminder of how the race didn't work out for you last year. What was it that didn't work last year? And then we can move into 2025 then this year.
Yeah, so I didn't have a great summer last year because I'd wanted to go out to the Alps to train. I left it too late to try and organize time off work, and I couldn't go out at all really to train. I went out for a fortnight, but I think it was in June or something like that. But it kind of put me in a bit of a negative frame of mind because I was thinking, oh, well, all these other girls out there, they're training out in the Alps full time and I'm in work. And then I did a lot of racing in the first half of last year and picked up an injury, which I couldn't shake, an Achilles injury, which I'll talk about later on as well, I'm sure, because my Achilles is my Achilles heel. It is my weakest thing. It's constantly one or the other is constantly flaring up no matter what I do. But anyway, yeah, so I had an Achilles issue, and then I was also doing a master's degree as well, so I was trying to get that finished. So I kind of went into the race in a very negative frame of mind, kind of thinking, you know, I don't really deserve to be here. I haven't put the work in. I sat down with my coach, Kim Collison, a few days before the race, and even before then, I just had this gut feeling things weren't going to go according to plan and I was probably not going to finish it. I didn't really see myself finishing it for some reason, and you know, I couldn't imagine myself at the finish line or whatever. And obviously there's always going to be that subconscious thing there. You might not have control of it, but it will be there grumbling in the background. And lo and behold, we set off, and within an hour my stomach was in pieces. I literally an hour into the race, I do suffer with stomach issues quite a bit. I'm kind of used to it, but I usually just vomit, and away I go, no bother. Yeah, puke. I call it the puke and rally. I don't mind that. The problem with this was it was coming out both ends, and I couldn't take anything in. So I ended up, yeah, that started really early on. So like the top of the first climb, and then down into Saint-Gervais wasn't very wasn't great really. I probably got a Strava segment record for the fastest run to the toilet once I got to Saint-Gervais. But yeah, and then it was just a bit of a grind to get to Les Contamines. Got into Les Contamines in really bad shape, but I was kind of just my I met my crew there, but I was kind of just pushed out the door and told to crack on with it. Didn't really give myself time to get myself sorted, get myself s settled, get my stomach settled, try and get something into me, trying to eat something. And within about 10 minutes of leaving Les Contamines, I was like, you know what? I'm done. I'm going to quit at the next aid station, because the next aid station is Les Chapeaux and you don't meet your crew there. And I was thinking, there's no way that anyone can convince me otherwise, because there's going to be no one there telling me to keep going. So I'm going to pull out there. So I made that decision very early on, that I was going to pull out at Les Chapeaux. And to be fair, once I'd made that decision, my body kind of imploded. So I ended up with these awful cramps in my legs, like I couldn't move. And I just basically staggered down to Les Chapeaux, and that was it. And I remember thinking, like I say, very early on, I was thinking, do you know what? This isn't my year. I'm going to quit. I'm going to come back next year. And see if I can do any better. So yeah,
Well,
that was.
isn't that alone a great lesson for everybody, you know, in life, that you can have an absolute nightmare experience, but that doesn't mean it's going to be like that every time. And just
No.
to, you know, go home, get yourself sorted, heal up, get back out training, get back out doing what you love, out running on the trails, and that result will come back, you know, and it did, didn't it? And it came back so well. And you know, if we fast forward, say, 8 months from that horrible nightmare weekend last year, you won the 100-miler in Slovenia, a big win there. And then you were 10th in Marathon du Mont Blanc. And I just wanted to ask you, in the lead up to UTMB, was that 10th, was that a good result for you, considering that, you know, you've won 8 out of your 12 races that I can see in the UTMB index. How was the 10th? Was that a confidence building run, or was the 10th a bit of a disappointment in any way?
Yeah, no, the 10th was a disappointment. So it was a bit strange. Yeah, it really was. I hadn't really thought much about Marathon de Mont Blanc, really. It was like, it was in the calendar for last year, you see, and I picked up this injury in my Achilles and I decided not to run Marathon de Mont Blanc to give it the best chance of recovery for UTMB. So I was only doing it Marathon de Mont Blanc because I hadn't done it last year. And I don't really know what happened. It was like I didn't have a fifth gear. Like, I just couldn't push. And I don't really know. I think probably altitude plays a big role in it. So I'm not very good at altitude at all. As soon as I go over like 2,000 meters, I just turn into a bloody snail. And and I found it just a real grind, and I just had nothing in me. It was frustrating because it was just like I didn't feel bad. Like I didn't really have any sickness or nausea. I didn't really have much stomach issues. I mean, I did puke, but only because I decided I was going to drink some sparkling water very quickly and a lot of it, which isn't a good idea because it's fizzy and it just goes in your stomach. But other than that, I didn't really have any like nutrition issues. I fueled well. I just didn't have a fifth gear, and I couldn't, no matter what I did, I couldn't seem to get into that, you know, to run, to push. And I did start to like reel some people in towards the end, because I think I only went into 10th place in the last kind of 15 or 20K. You know, I was starting to reel people in. Because it's a relatively short race for me. But yeah, it was a disappointing race because I had no explanation. Like, I had no excuse. I just couldn't push. So yeah, that was a wee bit frustrating. And that's
10 weeks then before UTMB. So then how do you turn it around, or were you able to turn it around? And did you go into last weekend with the confidence back up high? Or were those 10 weeks between Marathon de Mont Blanc and UTMB, were they a bit of a slog for you? How was the bridge between the two races?
Yeah, so I've had a summer of self-discovery and learning, which I needed to do, really. So last year, my excuse at UTMB was, I didn't spend any time in the Alps, and therefore I was at a disadvantage because all these other ones were spending time in the Alps. So I made the decision to take time off work, unpaid. So I took a total of 6 weeks off. So I did like a 4 week block after Marathon de Mont Blanc. I did a 4 week block, and then I came back home for 2 weeks because I had to go to work. And then I went out for the 2 weeks before UTMB. And so one of the reasons I think Marathon de Mont Blanc was kind of like a bit of a damp squib, as we say, a damp squid, is because I'd spent so much time like getting excited about going out for my 4 week block, because I literally, again, it's all because of work, but I had to fly out to Marathon de Mont Blanc. So I left on the Thursday, it was, I think, Wednesday or Thursday, I can't remember anyway. But and then I flew back to England on the Sunday, and I went to work that week. And I was heading out to France for 4 weeks, driving out the following Saturday. So like all my kind of time I would normally spend thinking about the race and preparing for the race, I was just more preparing to go and live in the Alps with my two dogs for the best part of 6 weeks. So I hadn't really, I wasn't really thinking and enough about the race and kind of visualizing the race and planning the race and what I need to do in the race, because I was too fixated on my trip. So I was really excited about the trip, and then I went out there and I can't remember what date it was. But anyway, not that long before I went out to Marathon de Mont Blanc, my other Achilles, the one that wasn't bothering me last year, decided to flare up very badly. So I was in this perilous situation where I was like, right, well, now I'm going out to the Alps full time, where I'm hoping to do 100 miles a week at least and big elevation. And I've got an Achilles that is completely buggered, for want of a better word.
Nightmare. So what happened? Yeah, were you able to put in that trainer block? I presume the answer is yes, because of the results you just got. But yeah, what happened?
Yeah, so I did put in the training block and I basically spent the entire 4 week block in pain, very frustrated, not really able to get the most out of my time there because I was trying to balance like recovery, trying to recover the Achilles while still maintaining volume. And it was a bit of a stressful situation. And then the other thing is I was out there on my own as well. So I was really lonely. And bored, actually. I realized, do you know what? I actually miss my job. I miss having a purpose in life. Like, I felt like my time out there was very selfish. It was for me and for me only. And I missed, like, having, you know, going to work and seeing all my friends and colleagues and having discussions and engaging my brain and doing practical work and feeling like I'm making a difference in life. And instead, I was kind of out there being like, I'm only out here for myself and I don't really like it. So that was something interesting that I learned while I was out there. And it kind of made me think, do you know what? I live in England. I live in the Lake District. Okay, we don't have 2,500 meter hills to go up, but the terrain is actually very, very similar. It's just smaller. And I was like, why am I out here? I could just be at home in England with, you know, good food, able to cook. Because I was camping. I bought a van. So I was just in a van. And, you know, I would be able to sit in at home in the evening and watch telly and, you know, cook a proper meal rather than just be, you know, cooking on a camp stove. And the weather was horrendous when I was out there. It was absolutely awful. And I was just sick of being cold. I was sick of being wet. You know, living in a small van, it's a VW caddy, a converted VW caddy, so it's not big, with myself and two wet dogs. Is not exactly enjoyable.
It's so, a far cry, isn't it, from the razzmatazz of Chamonix and UTMB weekend and all the YouTube videos that we see and all the influencers bouncing around the mountains of Mont Blanc, everybody happy. But yeah, that sounds miserable, doesn't it? And I presume that for next year, Emma, because you know you've raced so many 100 milers and you've got so much experience that, yeah, you won't be doing that again. You'll be staying close to your own home, your own routine, your work, your dogs, and maybe be, yeah, that little bit happier in the months of July and August in the lead up to it, hopefully.
Yeah, well, but like, as I said to my coach, it was like, I had to do that to prove to myself that that's not what I need. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah,
you know,
sure. Because if you hadn't got it done, you'd always be wondering, oh, should I be there?
Should I be there? You know, do I need that to really excel? And like, actually, like I say, I was like, well, no, I probably, okay, I'm not going to have a 12 kilometer climb like you do there, you know, like a 2 hour climb.
Yeah.
But I can certainly get the style of terrain. And the elevation to some degree, especially if I went to Scotland, you know, I probably could get that. And, you know, I'd sleep better because I was sleeping at altitude as well. So, you know, I was kind of living up at like 2,100 meters. And I think what I would do instead is get my acclimatization, you know, in the 2 weeks before the race. So like go out 2 weeks before the race and just live, you know, live up in Tiin or Val d'Isère or somewhere like that. So I can live at altitude for a couple of weeks beforehand and get the benefits then. Also try, you know, try and maybe focus. We didn't need to worry about heat acclimatization this year, but I suspect that, you know, it could be hot another year and maybe get a bit of heat acclimatization here, you know, in a sauna or whatever, rather than trying to get heat acclimatization at 2100 meters when it's raining every day is very difficult. But like I say, I was quite lucky because definitely heat acclimatization was not required this year.
Yeah, and I wonder what Josh Wade, who came third in the men's race, who's from the Lakelands as well, and I wonder, did he spend his summer in Chamonix, or was he happy to stay at home in the Lakelands? And I know from listening to an interview with Josh over the last couple of days, he was saying that, you know, one of the reasons for success is because he's lived in the Lakelands all his life and he spent so much time in the mountains there. So it'd be interesting to see, did he think that he had the need to
Yeah,
spend the
so
summer in?
I know Josh quite well.
Okay, yeah.
And he's a great guy. Oh, nobody deserves a podium more than that man. He works so hard and he's so enthusiastic and
Yeah,
he's
he's
so
huge.
keen and he's so good. So yeah, I actually randomly bumped into Josh in team. So he spent, I think it must have been about 6 weeks, would it be? Yeah, probably about. Or it might have been 4 weeks at T in team. He also actually, when I bumped into him, had the grumblings of an Achilles issue, but he was sensible and rested for a few days, unlike me,
Okay.
who just plowed through. But the thing is with Josh, like Josh lives, you know, lives, eats, breathes, dreams running. So he. You know, for him, it's the dream job that he has. You know, he is living his dream job. Whereas, yeah, for me, at the end of the day, I've been a vet for 11 years now. You know, it's a part of me, if that makes sense. So it's kind of,
Yeah.
it's very hard to then suddenly move away from it, which
Oh
is
yeah,
what
because
I've
at the end of the
been doing.
day, I mean, you know, we're not going to be running at this elite level for all our life either. So it might last 3 years, it might last 5 years, and it's so important to have that career to fall back on as well, especially when it's so such a big part of you. Emma, let's move to the Friday evening, and say around, you know, 5 o'clock, half five. Race starts at 5:45. How are you feeling then, after, you know, kind of the highs and lows of that time on your own, dealing with the Achilles? What's it like? And maybe as much as you can, describe what it's like for us, because, you know, 2,500 people at the start line, such a hard start line to get to. You know, it's a very difficult process to get there. Very, very spiritual place in terms of the trail running. The atmosphere is quite unique. What was it like for you in that 45 minutes hour just before the gun went off at 5:45?
I mean, it's oh, sorry, my other dog has just arrived. Hang on a minute. I'm just going to move.
Yeah, no
So
problems, no problems.
you'll just hear him barking for his dinner. I mean, I'd experienced it last year, and it was a bit of a shock to the system last year. I really
Yeah.
didn't like it.
Oh,
I
no, you
wasn't.
didn't like it. No,
No,
just
I'm
too
not. I'm not a.
long.
I'm not a people person. I don't
Okay,
really like.
yeah.
I don't like the crowds. I don't like the drama and the hype. I find it very uncomfortable and stressful. So I didn't like it, and it was a huge shock to the system because I had never experienced anything like that. So I went into it this year like completely accepting. I was like, you know, this is going to be horrible. It's going to be awful when you start, but just put your head down, just ignore everybody, and just go for it. So I did that. Like I literally just ignored everyone because if you're not used to the crowds, I find it can kind of get to you a little bit. It's a bit like overwhelming. It's a
Yeah,
bit.
and there's a lot of protocol, Emma, isn't there as well? And maybe the guys that were watching on YouTube mightn't have seen, but you know, we had 6 minutes of John Lennon, and Imagine. We had a speech from Catherine Poletti translated into English and to Spanish. So it does drag on, doesn't it? Then the presentation of all the elites. And Emma, were you in that presentation of the elites? Did you walk up through the middle of the road, or did you make your own way in to the start area?
I wasn't in like the presentation of like the top 10 elites because I think I was ranked 17th.
70th, okay, yeah.
But I was meant to walk up the aisle, but of course I'm late for everything. I am literally I cannot I'm all I'm if I'm 10 minutes late, I'm early, if that makes sense. I'm just not.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't do early. So anyway, I rocked up. We were meant to be at the starting pen at 5, and I rocked up at 5:15, and I was about to go in, which would have been like you go, you know, you walk up in front of everybody else. And I said, oh no, I better go for a wee before I start, because once I'm in the pen, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get back out. So I went for a wee, and by the time I came back, they closed it off to us. So I had to go in. I went in sideways, sideways instead. But actually,
actually, no, Harm, a little bit quieter. But it, yeah, it is spectacular, isn't it? Because just to paint the picture for people at home, like the streets are literally 6-7 rows deep. And I know sometimes people exaggerate, oh yeah, it was 6 rows deep. But it literally is 6 rows deep.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you have the top 10, the top 30 athletes walking down the middle of the road at the start line. And it's like the gladiators going into battle, isn't it? It's very WWE type spectacular. Yeah. It's pretty cool. But yeah, you know, if you just want to concentrate on your race and just, you know, go quietly to the start line, it's tricky if you're part of that whole elite process. But the gun goes off, and just as the gun goes off, and the weather changes and the rain begins to come down, and you have to deal with a tricky evening and a tricky night. How did you get on over the first couple of hours?
Oh, wow. The rain was something else. It was something else. It was, I don't know, I call it wet rain. Like, it was within 10 minutes, you're just saturated. Like, it doesn't matter how good your jacket is, it's not keeping you dry in that. And but it wasn't too cold at that stage. It was grand. So it was fine. I mean, the start is very, very fast. And actually, this new route they had this year was even faster because a lot of it's on the road. So there's a bit more climbing and it's a bit longer, but I'd say it's not really that much slower because of how fast, like just how fast the running is. So it's a bit, yeah, it's a bit of a shock to the system, really. You just go. But yeah, so I was running in my t-shirt for quite a bit. Even though like the heavens had opened as soon as we started, but I was running in my t-shirt, and then I was like, hang on a minute now, I think you need to put your jacket on, because you know, if you get really wet now, you're going to get really cold later on. So I did stop and kind of put my jacket over my bag, but it was a bit awkward because it's quite a like a tight fitting jacket, so it didn't really fit over the bag. So but anyway, so yeah, and I kind of held, I kept it like that till I got to Les Contamines. But by the time I got to Les Contamines, which was like kind of, I think it's about 3.5 hours, like the rain was still torrential, and I knew it was going to get really cold overnight, and people were talking about snow and hail on top of Col de Bonhomme and Col de la Seine. So at Les Contamines, I was like, right, we need to get a long sleeved. Like, I literally had like a winter layer, thermal base layer on that I put on at Les Contamines. And I'd actually put a new jacket in, like a second jacket in for Courmayeur. But I was so wet by the time I got to Les Contamines, I was like, I need a dry jacket now, which I'm so glad I did, because it got really cold. So on top of Col de Bonhomme, Col de Bonhomme, by then it was like sideways hail, and it was like battering my obviously I had like thermal base layer and a jacket on, so I wasn't too bad on the upper, but I was wearing shorts, and it was just like, it was like somebody stabbing your legs. It was just so cold and painful. And we ran down, and the good, this is where you're kind of where you're used to running in wet conditions, and I'm, you know, I'm sure Ireland's just as bad as England. I was overtaking hundreds of people on the descents, where they're literally like, you're just watching people like slide down this muddy trail on their bums, because it was so muddy and so slippery. But it's the sort of stuff I'm really used to, so I was just like bombing down past them, and I felt fantastic. I felt, this is like just at home. This is just like at home. And by the time I got to Les Chapu, my quads were destroyed, and I was like, oh, that was a really bad idea.
But it's just so hard that night, isn't it? Because it's this big race you've been looking forward to for months, you know, this spectacular start. You've got 5 or 6 kilometers of fairly flat, fast running, and everybody's still excited, everybody gets through the first climb okay, And then you're into three big, massive climbs as it gets dark. Rain's coming at you, cold's coming at you, snow's coming at you, pitch blackout. And you can understand why so many people don't get through that night. And especially the elites, Emma, as well. The dropout rate from the elites overnight, it's incredible, isn't it? So just, yeah, fair play to you for getting through all of that and coming out the other side.
I did get very cold, and that was one of my downfalls in the race, really. So when we got to Le Chapeau, and I think this was an absolutely fantastic decision on the part of the organisers, because, you know, a lot of the Europeans wouldn't really be used to running in those conditions. Now, to me, it was like running in the Lake District in winter. That's exactly what it was like. It was cold, it was wet, it was slippery. But the organisers, when we got into Le Chapeau, they were like, you need to put your long, they call them pants, you know, put your long pants on. You're not leaving this aid station without leg coverings. And every single person was forced to put on their lower leg wear, which was a really brilliant decision, because there's so many people that wouldn't have done it. And it actually could have got really, really dangerous, because going up the next climb, it then turned to like frigid snow. It was absolutely freezing. It was like -8 wind chill and snowing. And despite having long, you know, like trousers on, and a jacket and a thermal base layer, I was absolutely frozen. And my waterproof gloves, I usually keep my gloves in like the back of, just like in the stuff part of my bag, so they're easy to get at, because I tend to wear them a lot. By the time I took them out, they were saturated, like they were completely soaked. So I put them on. And I obviously, like, I put them on, and then I had my poles clipped over. I use Leckie poles, so I had them clipped over over the gloves. But the problem with that was I was still really, really cold, and then I didn't have the dexterity to unclip my poles, so I couldn't, because the gloves made my hands quite bulky. And I couldn't, if you've used Leckie poles, sometimes, especially the ultralight ones, they can be quite difficult to unclip. And with wet, cold hands in mittens, they weren't even gloves, they were mittens, I couldn't get them unclipped. And because of that, I couldn't eat. So I went the whole night not really being able to eat. I could drink a little bit from my bottles, but it was a bit awkward. Because I couldn't properly like grab them, so I was just trying to reach them without, like, you know, without grabbing them. So I got really depleted, because it was just so cold, and I couldn't eat or drink because I couldn't unclip my poles, basically. And it sounds so daft, but I thought it was okay at the time, but I paid for it later on. I really, really paid for it later on. I went through a very bad patch when the sun came up.
And, you know, it's fascinating to hear that, Emma, because we all see it, you know, get to the finish line. We all see it come to Chamonix when it's sunny again and, you know, you're coming through the streets. But none of us realize what you've gone through overnight. And I remember hearing Tom Evans, the winner, talking about how he couldn't open his gels. So what he had to do was, I think he actually got someone else to open his gels at one of the aid station and pour 3 gels into a bottle. So at least with the bottle, he could manage that a little bit better with his frozen hands than trying to open up a gel on his own. So very, very tough conditions. But you did get through it, Emma. And like, I was just looking at the stats, and you were 131st overall at midnight. And then as you came through Saturday morning, you were in the 70s and you finished 70th. So despite all of that agony and hardship and just really tough conditions, you moved from 131st to 70th, which just shows, I think, just, how strong you are mentally and physically. You know, just, again, fair play to you. Brilliant.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it wasn't, like, my finest race, I think, because I made a few rookie errors like that overnight. You know, I should know better. You know, that's the sort of weather I train in all winter. I should have known better, but you have this different mindset when you're in Europe, because you always think, oh, it's so hot in Europe and the weather's always really good. And, you know, you don't expect snow on in the Alps in August. You know, you don't expect that. So I kind of, yeah, I underestimated that and paid for it. And but yeah, it was a good, I think the best thing about it was like the learning experience, because you know, I learned a lot from it. You know, I learned a lot last year when I DNF'd, and then I learned a lot this year with a few different things like pacing and the nutrition side, and yeah, just I suppose the terrain as well. Like I didn't, when I went over for the month in the summer, I didn't want to recce the route. I felt like I have recced it before. I have like this like weirdly good memory for routes, so I can kind of remember them. I remember the turns and things like that. And so I was like, well, I don't really need to recce the route because I remember it, and I did remember it. But actually, what I didn't remember was like how runnable some of the runnable sections are. And I felt totally unprepared for the runnable section. So like my worry when I was like out there for the month, I was like, I need to practice the climbs. It's the climbs, the really long climbs, the climbs that I can't get at home. I need to be climbing, 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 and then descending, descending, descending. And I completely neglected the fact that like in the middle there is like some horrendously runnable sections. And so I was a bit annoyed with myself because A, I'd forgotten how runnable they were, like I forgot how long they went on for. And B, I didn't have that like extra kick that I probably needed on those sections to like not lose time. So like on some of those sections I lost a lot of time. Like a lot of people who overtook me on like the, I call them the douchebag gradients. So like the very, very, very gentle uphill slope. So like when you leave Champé-Lac, when you leave Champé-Lac, you have this like quite long descent. Like it's just a lovely, nice gradient descent on a gravel track. It's lovely. But it then just turns, it just kicks slightly and it turns into this, oh, it must only be like 4, 5, 6% gradient. It's not much of a gradient at all. And but it's just enough that when you've done 100 and I don't know, 30 kilometers or something like that, it's enough to really destroy you. And I lost time on that. I think two people, I think it might have been two people overtook me on those types of sections, those kind of runnable uphill.
Yeah, well, I was gonna say, Emma, I think it sounds like a race where you need to be good at everything. You need to be good at climbing, you need to be good at the runnable flatter sections, and then you need to be good at descending as well. Like if you look at that last descent into town, even, you know, when you've got what, about 170 kilometers in your legs, you've got a quite a tricky technical descent at about 11, 12% into town. After all of that, so you really do have to be a master of the three aspects of climbing, running on the flat, and then descending as well. And I might just ask you about that final descent into Chamonix. And we spoke briefly about it at the finish line, because you were just behind the GOAT. You were just behind the legend of the sport, Courtney, who all at Chamonix had stayed at the finish line to come in and see. And she came home in 10th place. And just, I thought it was such a courageous, wonderful run from her. The champion, the three-time champion, she didn't have a good day in one way. You know, she's used to winning this race, and a lot of elites probably would have dropped out going from first, where she's used to, back down to 10th and moving back down through the field. But to see her finish because of the joy of the race, of running in the race, and the joy of interacting with the crowd, I thought was special to see. And then, of course, she was just ahead of you. And there is, you know, that extra prestige of coming in the top 10, because the next day the top 10 ladies go up onto the stage. And I think I asked you maybe at the finish line, did you have any intel coming to you that Courtney was just 6, 7 minutes ahead of you? Did you get anything? Did anybody say anything to you?
Right. So I think this is the point of like the whole thing that like frustrates me the most. And it's not the fact that, oh, I could have beaten Courtney. No, no, no. It's got nothing to do with that. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It could have been any woman. It doesn't matter. It was phenomenal to see Courtney push. Now, obviously, I had no idea at the time. I didn't have a clue what state she was in and how much pain she was in. I had no idea. But when you start watching the videos afterwards, I have so much respect for that woman to keep going. Like, she really, it's like she did it for everybody. Like, she did it for the mid-packers. I've seen, you know, people, mid-packers, back of the packers, thanking her. Because it's so refreshing for them to see, you know, the best in the world going at paces that they can relate to. You know what I mean? And fair play to her for continuing, because as you say, anyone anyone else could have DNF, because this is the issue with your ITRA rating or your UTMB index. You're better to DNF than to have a bad race. And I think that's one of the fundamental issues with the system for elite athletes, is that it almost encourages DNF, and it shouldn't be like that. Like, I think anyone who perseveres and finishes the race, you know, should be rewarded more than someone who DNFs because they don't want it to impact their rating, which I think does happen.
And just on the UTMB index, Emma, before we come back to that little battle maybe with Courtney and the other women in the top 10, top 15, Emma, I was looking up your UTMB index earlier, and it's 721 points, but I had to go to page 18 to find you. And on each page, like, there's about 20 athletes, which means, you know, you're ranked, down on something like 350th, 360th, which in one way shows just the calibre of female trail running. But then on the other side, I can't understand, Emma, because you've won 8 out of 12 races in the last couple of years. So how are you down on page 18 of the UTMB index? A bit bizarre. I don't know if you noticed that yourself. I'm sure you did. Or if you have any thoughts on it. Or does it even matter?
Oh, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me at all. But again, it's... I don't know. I mean, I probably... So I tend to race... only like my biggest races are usually like the 100, 200 mile distances, which carry a lower UTMB index, I think.
Is it? Okay.
Ones. Yeah, okay. I think it does. So like your kind of your classic like 50K, 100, like 100K distances tend to have a higher... Oh, well, I don't know. I might be talking rubbish. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't bother me. Excuse me,
eight wins out of 12, Emma. The results are what matters. And back to the results, 11th overall. And while you didn't get into the top 10, like the caliber of athlete, Emma, that you did come in ahead of, despite all the troubles over the summertime, just to give you one example, the Spanish athlete that was 13th, an hour and 20 minutes behind you, Maite Mayorda, she's a sky running world champion. She's a trail running world champion with the Spanish national team, and she's won every trail race going in Spain. So to come in ahead of an athlete like that, despite the difficulties that you had, again, just a wonderful, wonderful race, Emma. And, you know, I'm sure you're very determined to go maybe one better next year and get into that top 10. Is that the big goal now, or is it too early to tell? You're just in recovery mode at the minute.
No. So, yeah, this is the thing, right? So I suppose, yeah, going back there a few minutes, like, one of my frustrations is that I had no idea, like, how close I was to 10th place at all. Basically, I left Valenciennes and I asked my support, like, how far ahead is 10th lady? And that would have been, who was in 10th? Whoever, I can't remember who finished 9th in the end.
Was
I can't
it
remember.
The other Spanish athlete, Claudia Tromp? I think Tramps, oh, Claudia Tramps was 9th.
Yeah. So I said, how far ahead is 9th, you know, 10th place at that point? And they said 25 minutes. And I was like, I can't make up 25 minutes over the next 18 kilometers. Like, I can't, you know, that's not possible. Because I figured, she might be moving a bit slower. Even if she was moving a bit slower than me, I was like, I can't make up 25 minutes. So I kind of was like, my best hope, either one, I'm going to pass somebody sitting on the side of the trail who's completely imploded, or I just, you know, that's could happen, or I'm just going to try and maintain 11th place, because that was my hope, really. And so I set off, and I actually felt really, really good on the last climb, probably the best I'd felt all day. I felt really strong, and I, you know, I really enjoyed that last climb. And so I got to the top, and actually I saw a couple of people I knew, and nobody said anything to me. And the girl behind, the woman behind me, oh, she was phenomenal on the flat, and she was phenomenal on the uphill, and she kept overtaking me on the uphill, and like it was just backwards and forwards all day. Susanna,
that the German athlete, was it Susanna Lauer?
She was incredible. Yeah, she was so strong climbing. But she wasn't so strong on the descents. So I knew that once I was at the top of La Flagère, I was going to be okay, because I knew that no matter what, I was going to be able to descend quicker than her. So, of course, I got to the top of La Flagère. I looked behind me. There wasn't anybody there. So I'm just like, grand, job's good. Right, we're going to finish 11th here. I just dilly-dallied my way down. And it's not a very nice descent on a good day, but it's definitely not very nice when your quads have been left in Les Chapeaux about 15 hours earlier. So I just like casually just like dotted down, you know, very, very slowly, taking my time, blah, blah, blah. And I got to below La Floria, so that little refuge that's kind of... after it just, it's basically marks the end of the technical section, just beyond that, that maybe I don't know, half a K after that, I met my coach, and he was like, I don't know if you can do it, but Courtney is moving really, really slowly, and she's only just about 10 minutes ahead. I don't know if you can do it, but try. And that was only 3 kilometers from the finish. And I did. I tried, but I knew I couldn't. It wasn't enough time.
I think you got it down to about six and a half.
Yeah, and if somebody had told me at the top of La Flagère, I would have given it a good run. If somebody said, "Listen, Courtney is moving really slowly. She's passed through here only 20 minutes ago," which I think it was something like 20 minutes, for it. I would have just opened the taps and I would have done my best. I may not have caught her. Yeah, 100%, I may not have caught her, but I would have been happy knowing that I had done everything I could to do it. I think that's my biggest frustration, is the fact that I had just like, I had switched off by the time I got to La Flagère. I was like, right, okay, 11th place, that's where you're going to be. Just take your time now, just get into the finish, la, la, la. Whereas I should have just been like, no, Emma, the race isn't over. You know, keep going. Even if even if nobody had told me, I should have had that mindset and just said, you know, just keep going, go as fast as you can. But I didn't.
But you know what, Emma? So sometimes not having that perfect finish will leave you with that desire and motivation for next summer. And that will keep the fire burning all over the winter. You know, knowing that you just missed out on that top 10, knowing that you just missed out on the scalp of the greatest of all time, knowing that, I think that will give you that extra motivation. It will help keep you going as well. And, you know, maybe nice for Courtney as well. The running gods looking after her as well, giving her top 10 as well. So, you know, she got a nice reward after putting in such a brilliant display for trail runners. And then it will give you that little hunger to keep you going for next year as well. Maybe the best of both worlds.
My goal had always been, you know, this year my goal was to finish, because I hadn't finished last year. But like my secondary goal was going to be, well, try and get top 10. And I think had I got top 10, I think I would have been happy. And I would have said, right, I'm going to close the book on UTMB. I've done it. You know, I'm happy. I've got top 10. Great. But instead now I've got this, well, can I do better? You know, can I take what I've learned this year and can I go back and try and be better again and finish top 10, but as high in the top 10 as I can. And
You know, I'm getting so excited, Emma, as you even say that as well. And like, you
it
know,
won't
you
be
do you
2026.
look at Tom Evans, the winner this year. He was third, but then two DNFs over the last 2 years, and he came back and he won it. So it does
Well,
take a couple of runs at it.
I'm going to follow Josh in Josh's footsteps. So Josh had a DNF, then an 11th place, and then a third place. So,
oh,
you know,
absolutely. We'll take
I've had
that.
a DNF. I've had a DNF and an 11th place, so we'll see what's next. But no,
Yeah.
it won't be next year. I've already decided I'm going to take a year away from UTMB, and I'll hopefully I'm going to go and try and qualify next year. Because the problem is I've not got a qualifying race at the moment. So
Okay,
me, for me to
Emma, I
run
was
next
getting my
year.
hopes up there for a podium 2026. I have to wait 2 years
Sorry.
now. Oh no.
No. Because for me to qualify now, I'd need to do one of the last few races that are
Yeah,
left.
which is the frustrating part of it, isn't it? Yeah, it is
And
very frustrating for yourself and the top guys.
I don't have a 100-mile race, like a competitive 100-mile race in me this year at the moment. I need to take a
Yeah.
bit of a chill. It was easy.
And can you double check, Emma? Because I know, Hank, is there a UTMB index number, like that's a cutoff where if you're above a certain number, they'll give you an elite entry? Have you looked at that as well?
No, you still have to qualify.
You still have to qualify. Yeah.
Yeah,
Okay. Okay.
yeah,
Okay.
yeah, yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. Well, 2027, Emma, bring it on. Bring it on. Emma, thanks a million for bringing us through that. And, you know, when I talk to somebody like yourself who's just done a really great 100 miler, I hope the listeners are happy with what we've spoken about, because there's so many things that we could talk about that you would have experienced through the 100 miles. But hopefully they got a good taste of what you went through and picked up a couple of tips. And Emma, just again, absolutely inspirational to see you do so well. So congratulations again on a wonderful performance, and thank you for joining us. I know you're very busy there. You're probably in recovery, relaxed mode as well. So thanks a million for joining us this evening, Emma. A real pleasure, and can't wait to see you in action again.
Graham, thanks very much.
Well, there we have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Emma. What an inspirational figure in Irish trail running, and what a result last week for her in Chamonix. Before we go, a big thank you one last time to our sponsor this month, Eco Trail Wicklow 2025. Sign up soon, guys, if you haven't already done so, so you don't miss out this year. Remember that you've got 5 race distances from 10k up to 80k to choose from, and lots of fun will be had in Bray Promenade on September 27th with the team from all the Eco Trail Wicklow team, and of course with the guys from Wicklow Wolf Brewery on hand at the finish line as well. It's going to be a great day. Get registered, guys, and can't wait to see you there. For now, everybody, get your running gear on. Let's go.